how, you know, it would seem that a lot of the contextlessness of information online and having to sort of shout into the void and get the attention of strangers and sort of shout over other people is just doesn't bode well for the ways that we need to collect and have conversations, and that's kind of tried and true in the history of activism.
We'll talk more about that in a moment. I'm here with Ginny O'Dell. She is the author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Ginny O'Dell. She's the author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. And Ginny, I'm reminded of something you wrote about that really struck me about how it was at one time we would go to, let's say, our phone on the wall and make a call to another person. And we'd have that conversation, and maybe we'd call back if we didn't finish the conversation. Mm-hmm. And now it's very, very different, as you say. It's just coming at us, and we click, and we go for something, and I think you call it, like, two-dimensional.
Yeah, I think what it's missing is intentionality, context, and agency. So, you know, I'm old enough to remember the phone on the wall. You know, like, I remember that, you know, if I wanted to talk on the phone, we did not have a cordless phone in my house. So I had to be, if I was on the phone, I was standing in a specific part of the house, right? I went there to contact someone, even if it was, right, if it was just a chat, right? That's still, I've still chosen a person to chat with for a certain amount of time. And it wasn't this sort of like ambient thing that was always in the background. It was something that I made a decision about. And to me, it feels very similar to, you know, what I think I describe in the same section, where the difference between, for example, being on Twitter or going to the library. So when I go to the library, that's a spatial experience where you have to make decisions about the information that you want. If I am researching, you know, ecology, I have to go to the ecology section of the library, and the things that I see there make sense next to each other, because I'm in the ecology section. So, you know, it's so different than, you know, when I go onto Twitter, there's a lot of information there that is immediately thrown at me. I've compared it before to, like, it's as if you were to go into a library and have books thrown at you as soon as you walk in the door.
Well, you know what I call that, Ginny? Like, being in the library, what I call that is incidental contact. Mm. You hear what I'm saying? That it's like you go and you're looking for this one book, but you notice this other book is next to it, and you go, oh, that looks interesting. Mm-hmm. That's that incidental contact that you wouldn't have had if you hadn't gone for that mm-hmm. first one in the first place.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's...
Yeah, and I mean, I've found some of the most important books to me, like, in that way, you know, and not just libraries, but, you know, I live near a great bookstore, Walden Pond, and just the way they arrange it makes that very easy, right? And so I think that that's still so different from the experience of having a bunch of unrelated information thrown at you. And it's not just unrelated. I mean, it depends on, you know, who you follow on Twitter, but I think for a lot of people, it's this kind of dystopian mix of things that are really upsetting, things that are supposed to be funny, things that have to do with your close friends, things that have to do with strangers. Like, all of these contexts are completely different, and you're just kind of like, there's this whiplash of kind of going back and forth, and you never sort of gain that sense of intentionality and agency where you never even had a chance to decide if you wanted to see anything or what you wanted to see. And especially as these behaviors become more addictive and more ingrained, it's like you're not even making a decision about whether to be on Twitter in the first place. And so I think that there's so much potential in anything that can kind of recenter or replace the center of gravity back in yourself, where you are making those decisions. And unfortunately, you know, this technology is designed specifically to take that away from you. But I think even just being aware of that is kind of a first step.
That's right. That's right. Just being, knowing wherever we're clicking and maybe doing our research, we are being researched.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
So that not only are we researching somebody, all those engineers out there who have done all those algorithms of clicking and everything, they're noticing where we are and what we're doing, and then they start to move us toward something you talk about, the gated communities of our attention. I mean, that just really struck me, because you think of gated communities that we kind of cordon ourselves off into these little silos of how we live and who we live with. But you take it even a step further as gated communities of our attention, and that you talk about social media and the internet can be like that as well.
Yeah, and that phrase specifically is meant to, you know, I'm trying to tie some of these issues that I'm talking about that seem like they would strictly have to do with the internet. I'm trying to tie them to, you know, environmental politics and things like land use. So it's, you know, it's all well and good for me to say things like, you know, you should, one antidote to the attention economy is to spend more time in contact with the non-human world, right? It's easy for me to say that, easy for me to go to the Rose Garden. I live near a Rose Garden, but you just look simply at like the way a city is laid out, especially Oakland, right? There's more parks in one part than there are in another. And then I also talk about the fact that, you know, several tech giants have been known for actually placing a lot of restrictions on themselves with how they use technology, not letting their children use phones at the table.
So these are the movers and shakers of all the technology that also limit it for their own children.
Yeah, right. It's like you, at a certain point, you have enough money to maybe you buy your weekend home and then you go there with your family and you don't use technology, right? It's like it's...
But that's a privilege.
It's a privilege, right? And so, yeah, that's when I say gated communities of attention, it's my concern that the problems of the attention economy are kind of in a really intricate way bound up with things that we wouldn't consider part of the attention economy, but are, you know, part of the basis of the kinds of attention that you would need to cultivate to be able to defend yourself. So if you don't have access to those kinds of spaces, or for example, you're a parent who has, you know, an overworked single parent with three kids, like, of course you're going to put iPads in front of them because you're just trying to get through the day, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So you're saying that even though there's a varying degree of opportunity for different people to participate in certain ways, doesn't mean we shouldn't participate then.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, one thing that was really important for me to talk about in the book, and because, you know, the easiest argument to what the easiest rebuttal to what I'm saying is like, well, you know, what about someone who, you know, has trying to hold down three jobs and like has no time to do the things that you're talking about? Like, this sounds like a luxury, right? And I agree with that. I don't think it should be a luxury, but I do acknowledge that there's a kind of, you know, I call it a margin of refusal that varies for different people, right? Like, I think I am very privileged and I have a wide margin. It's not the widest, but it is, you know, a margin where I can make decisions like to go sit in the Rose Garden, whereas, you know, there are a lot of people for whom that's not an option. And so, you know, what I say in the book essentially echoes what a lot of people have said about privilege, which is that if you find yourself with some of it, you should use it to create more space for others, you know?
Right.
But in order to do that, you have to disengage from the attention economy in order to, you know, first of all, think straight, also find and communicate intentionally with other people that could help you with that or have been working on that already. And as I say at the end of the book, I think that these problems are bound up in with, you know, not only the environment, but, you know, just capitalism in general, and that you can't, there's no quick fix in this book because of how these things are so related. But that also means that putting your efforts toward any of those things, like any parts of that knot, are going to help.
You give an example, though, of someone who I think we can look at as a model of who has done this pretty well, and that's the Trappist monk Thomas Merton. Being that kind of monk really is considered kind of, they move away from normal life. They mostly don't talk, although he did, because they asked him to teach, so he did a lot of talking. But he also was very engaged in the world, both on the environmental issue. He's passed on now, for those who don't know him. He was a resistor of the Vietnam War, and he wrote a lot about that. He participated in the world, and yet he was a reclusive monk. And can you say something about that?
Yeah, I was really inspired by his story, partially because, you know, one of the books that he initially was well known for was Seven Story Mountain, which is such it's such a recognizable sentiment right now. It's this sort of like a cry of despair and the sort of like rejection of the world, and it sold so many copies because I think people felt, you know, they felt that. And then, you know, somewhat surprisingly, and not that long after that, you know, he was writing to a friend and basically disowned that book and said, you know, I had to go into town to, you know, occasionally you have to go into town. And he looked around on a street corner and realized that he felt, you know, beholden to all of these people around him, that he loved other people and needed to be in the world, and that he'd sort of made a mistake in how he had articulated this. And so from that point on, a lot of his writing is very engaged in political issues. And he, you know, still from a remove, right? Like still from his little hut, like, you know, he wasn't just, on the property, but he had his own little, he was a hermit, right? Like on,
exactly.
in that place. And so I just find that sequence of events or that kind of evolution is really inspiring to me as someone who, you know, has sometimes feels like I'm having a reaction like that, but then it, knowing, you know, kind of how he dealt with that, it helps you move beyond that initial knee-jerk reaction to sort of reject everything and try to find a way to, you know, remain on the fringes, at least conceptually, looking kind of almost looking at the present from the point of view of a utopian future, but not exiting the present altogether. And I think it's actually really hard to do, but I think that's kind of the only option that we have.
So this is part of what you would talk about, a resistance in place.
Yeah.
In his place, he was a recluse.
Yeah.
But he was standing like that useless tree, so to speak.
Yeah.
Providing great shade. I'm thinking, when I read about the useless tree, Jenny, I was thinking about that other book that some of us read many, many years ago and were very disturbed by. It was called The Giving Tree.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which is just the opposite of the useless tree. Do you recall that book?
Yeah. The whole tree gets used up, right? It is actually, you know, now that you mention it, it is the opposite. It is the most useful tree, and look what happens to it.
And look what happens. It totally, the very last picture in the book is a little boy is sitting on this stump. And it was so depressing, and it was, oh my gosh. So I was thinking of that in conjunction with what you were talking about. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Jenny O'Dell, and she is the author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, jennyodell.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. here with Ginny Odell. She's the author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Ginny, in reading your book, I was reminded of a moment when I was in a large group. And within that large group, we would divide up into smaller groups at some point. And in my smaller group, which became, we were together like for 2 weeks, and my smaller group stayed consistent, the same people within that smaller group that met for part of the day. And one of the members of that smaller group was a woman who grew up in Moscow under communism. And her English was not very, very good, and so it was hard for her to express her frustration in being with Westerners, with us. And finally, towards the end, she was able to convey to us how painful it was to be with us. And she said that it was because in growing up under communism in the years that she did, that she had to start to edit her own thoughts, because if she even had a thought that was against the regime, that then she might act on it, and then it would be very detrimental to her well-being in real physical ways. So she started to imprison her own thoughts. And being around Westerners was so difficult, because we were always just jumping in with the next thought, and we would be talking in this group, and we'd get an idea, and suddenly we'd interrupt each other, and we'd just pop out of our heads with the first thing in our mind, or first thing in our, you know, it's just like, you know it, how we are. And somehow, in reading your book and being in your book, I'm reminded the internet and social media is kind of like that. Do you see the analogy?
I do, but I actually see the analogy on both sides. So I think that it, you know, it's exacerbates or maybe provides an easier platform for people to have, you know, hot takes, you know, knee-jerk reactions, you know, tweeting without thinking, you know, retweeting an article without reading it, like all kinds of these things, right? But also, because things have become so polarized online, and it's you can very easily get an angry Twitter mob if you sort of say the wrong thing, I think people also, in a strange way, I don't know that they're necessarily like editing their thoughts, but they are certainly producing, I think often cynically producing expressions that they know will do well on that platform. And often that's things that create outrage, things that kind of push the right buttons, people that signal certain things to certain groups, right? And so on either side, right, you don't have what you would like, which is a person who maybe paused and reflected and gave themselves enough time to complete a train of thought. And then not only, you know, had that pause, but then shared that with the people that it makes sense to share that with, right? Not everyone, or like, you know, hundreds of thousands of strangers.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And the whole ethos is to have more likes and more people clicking on your Twitter, or more fans or more friends or more, on and on and on. And then we buy into that. And I'm thinking, one of my phrases when I have to work with my computer a lot and on the internet a lot, and I'll get some information from somewhere, and then someone said, oh, well, look up on my Facebook page. You know, you can find the information here. And Ginny, I just like recoil. I'm sorry. And I have to say to them, what I say is, I'm very old fashioned. I use email. And in this day and time, that is kind of old-fashioned. It's like another old technology that is kind of losing its relevance.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I find that very troubling, because I just, you know, and I'm not the only person, actually, Gia Tolentino, book, you're, you know.
I have another book. I have to tell our listeners, I have another book on my desk here, Trick Mirror by Gia Tolentino, and I recommend that too. And Ginny saw the book on the desk, and she said, oh, yeah, that's great.
Yeah. But I think, you know, she talks about this in her book, and I also just heard an interview with her where she says that, you know, that the internet is like a diversion of energies, right? It's like you have a lot of, you know, scary things happening. You have people who have real emotions about that. And instead of in a sort of reasoned or thoughtful way, like taking a moment to think about what you might actually do or who you can talk to or any of these things, right? Like, instead of funneling your energy there, it just goes into this weird kind of like sea of like a shouting match that, and that in expressing yourself there, you feel that you're doing something, but you're actually not doing anything. The only thing you're doing is generating revenue for a social media company. That's the only thing you're doing.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And let me just quote, because I wrote something out from her book. She said, capitalism has no land left but to cultivate the self. And you really talk about that, too. Everything is being cannibalized, not just goods and labors, but personality in relationships and attention. Mm-hmm. So she's just really going right along with what you have discovered, that it's all being co-opted for capitalist reasons to make more money.
Right. And that totally thrives on a sense of almost like hyper-individualism. So I'm actually reading an amazing book right now with a surprising title called Against Creativity.
All right, let's write that one down. Who's that by?
It's by Oli Mould, M-O-U-L-D. So O-L-I.
O-L-I-M-O-U-L-D.
And I'm halfway through it, but he makes this really, it's like this point, I don't know why it's never occurred to me before, especially as an artist, but, you know, he says, like, creativity in the service of, or that's been co-opted by capitalism is not creativity. He basically says that. He says real creativity is that which kind of branches out towards others and actually forms something new in the world. So like for him, collectivizing a workplace would be something that's actually creative. And I read that and I was like, oh, this is... this, you know, it just puts words to something that I've been feeling. I think Gia also talks about this in her book. I feel like she would appreciate his book as well. But, you know, there's something really twisted about the idea that making these expressions of yourself and your sort of political identity online are, A, generating revenue for these companies, and B, you feel like that's sort of doing something for you. Like as an individual,
right.
You know, it's so individualistic,
right.
It's so narcissistic. And yet it's, you know, narcissism is addictive and you get caught in this cycle and it just, you know, when I think about it, I get caught in it too. Right. And then, but when you wake up from that dream, it's like, there are people around you that you need to reach out to, that the only way anything is going to get done is if you do that.
I'm reminded of something I learned years ago when you talk about that reaching out and you don't know what's going to come out of that reaching out. That's the creative space because mm-hmm. it's not yours individually and you haven't planned it all out. And I'm thinking of the way termites work. And I've been told that, like, you know, these big mounds that termites do, inside those mounds are very intricate archways that are almost like Rococo in their design. I mean, they're very, very lacy-like or is the way I imagine it. So the termites on one side of the mound will be working, and the termites on the other side of the mound will be working. And somehow they work, and then somehow these archways come together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's no architect.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody laid down plans for this, and there's no director of design here or anything. It's just this thing that happens inside this termite mound. And I'm just, I was reminded of that when you were talking about that kind of reaching out in our creativity. And this is something very exciting for us for the future if we can take, as you said very early on, time and space for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's, you know, I love that that's an example. It's basically like an ecological example. I, you know, talk a lot in the book about examples of emergence and interdependence that from ecology that have inspired me. You know, I feel like that's a really important part of my identity. I'm biracial, so I am some, you know, we all emerge from two different, you know, sides, but I feel that very kind of distinctly. And even my work has often been interdisciplinary. I would say this book is a product of my encounter with things that I didn't expect. So I feel a little bit like preoccupied with the things that emerge in unexpected ways between two different contexts or two different viewpoints. And that's something that I think we is threatened right now, but it's also like the thing that we need the most.
Right. And I think that you just briefly, we're running out of time, but when you talk in the book about the gentrification of neighborhoods in Brooklyn, when the AIDS epidemic made so much apartments available, and then all these people moved in that had no history in the place, and there was not this cross fertilization, is what I'm saying. And then we have to mind our gentrification of the mind, mm-hmm. and our creativity. Jenny, we could go on and on. I want to thank you so much for being with us on New Dimensions.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's been my pleasure. I've been speaking with Jenny O'Dell, and she is the author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. And if you want to know more about her work, you can go to her website, which is jennyodell.com, or you can give there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3689.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. This program was recorded at Strawberry Hill Productions, a full-service podcast production studio in Novato, California. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Take a look at our program lineup at cjsf.ca to discover the diverse range of contents we bring to you.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.